please wheel the books and check. Please wheel the books, oh, those books, and check envelope back to Robin's desk after class. Okay. Will somebody remind me? So where was I? Yes. For those of you who haven't been in the intensive, it's likely to be the case that you won't have a feel for what that option of creating a simulated a clinical case looks like until you get some experience in this class actually participating in them. And that's fine. I mean, we have plenty of time in order to do that, okay? So I would not worry at all about that. Oh, we still have folks coming in.
Sorry.
Now, that's okay. It just looks like we have more than we're registered. In a minute, I'll stop this and I'll call the roll. But so you have, again, the midterm. You have the final project, which is usually a group project, can be of different types. And then the other aspect of the grade is fundamentally your participation both in those simulated games and in the classroom dialogue. Now, if you also look at the syllabus, you'll see that the midterm examination is given out, it's a take-home examination. And in effect, I give you a class off because you're not doing it here. What we're doing is after the break, and I'll address in a minute, I might have to change that date, but as of now, what we're doing is where it says on page 6, no classes March 10 and March 17, March 10 is spring break. What I am now currently planning on doing, and if there's a change, I'll let you know very soon, is giving out the midterms on March 3rd and having you hand them in when you return from those 2 weeks off on March 24th. And again, the only adjustment that I might have to make is instead of March 17th, March 24th might become the canceled class. But let's deal with that, you know, next week. I'll think that through, all right? But I just want you to be aware of the fact that in lieu of taking the exam in class, you will get that time out of class in which to complete the exam. Let me go back to the enrollment here. So we have Shauna. Okay, Shauna. Katrina, I know, is here. Tanya.
Yes.
Thank you, Tanya.
Tania.
Tina. Tania. Got it. I got it right the third time. Misa?
Mesa.
Mesa. David, yes. Victoria. Hi, Victoria. We met before. Then I have Rebecca.
Uh-huh.
Thanks, Rebecca. And Nicole. Hi, Nicole. And Steve Miller. Steven. Steve or Steven?
Steve's good.
Steve's good. Okay. Katie Reiser, I know. Christina Marie. There you are. Daniel. Suffing or Seffing?
Sophie.
Or Seffing. Okay. Corbett is here. And Bridget is here. Unrelated Walsh's. Catherine West.
Here.
Hi, Catherine. I see Richard Whittington is here. Wei Shu, hi Wei, and Paula Udenfriend. Hi Paula. Now, are there people whose name I didn't call? I thought we had more. So, 1, 2, 3. Now, are you guys actually registered?
No.
Yes.
I'm not.
But are you registered?
Yeah.
You're registered.
As of like yesterday, I think.
You did? Okay. Are you registered? You, I'm sorry. Okay. Okay. So why don't I do this? Let me have a piece of paper go around, and the people whose names I didn't call, put down your names and your contact information so that I know who you are, and then I can check to see whether when we print out the new class list that you appear on it, okay? And that means that if you're all in the class, we will go from what was 18 to, I think, 22, which is fine. I don't have a problem with that. I forget what they listed the maximum at for this course. Section limit 30, so it's fine. Not a problem at all. So why don't I pass this around, and you guys can just hand me that. But as I said, rather than just call your names and get you to raise your hand, I think it would be useful and pleasant for us to all talk a little bit about who we are, what your background is, what your thoughts are about the utility of this process for you, and if you're not already in a mid-career setting that you plan to continue, give me some idea of what it is that you project doing in the future. So, can we start with you?
My name is Becky, and I am currently in law school and just transferred up here. I was in Florida last year.
Right.
Transferred to Drexel, actually. I'm doing a law concentration there.
Okay.
I hope to do health policy related issues, which is why I'm kind of started doing. This is my first semester at bioethics, my first class.
Very good.
Yeah.
Did you want to say something else? That's fine.
I'm Victoria. I'm a law student here at Penn in my third year and a master bioethics student. And I figured mediation would be a good class because all I've been doing in law school is litigation, and so this would be a nice alternative to that field.
And we'll talk a lot about that alternative aspect. And your name is?
I'm Amy Barenbaum. I know I'm enrolled. I don't know why.
Okay. Well, this was printed out. This is only the 7th, so it was several days ago. So Amy Sandbaum?
Barenbaum.
Oh, Barenbaum. Oh, wait a minute. I had your name. Are you also taking the intensive?
Yeah.
You are? Okay. I knew your name. Okay. So tell us about yourself.
I just graduated in December from Penn, and a semester early, and I'm starting the MBE program full time. And I studied health policy and law as an undergrad, and I'm planning on law school. I have experience as an EMT, so a little bit of clinical experience, and I work at the Leonard Davis Institute of Health Economics on campus.
Oh, that's great. Mm-hmm. Thank you very much. Mm-hmm. Bridge?
Hi, I'm Bridget Walsh. I'm a dual degree student in the social work and MBE program. This is my final semester, and I'd like to work as a medical social worker in a hospital setting doing mediation and kind of clinical ethicist type thing in the future, so this seems appropriate. And I've done the two intensive courses, which were just not enough time with Ed.
That must be it. Katie? Thank you. Yes.
My name is Leanne. I'm a research coordinator in the Department of Cardiovascular Medicine.
Could you speak a little louder, Wei?
I'm a clinical research coordinator working at the Department of Cardiovascular Medicine. Mm-hmm. And I'm doing a part-time MBA program. Actually, this course is my sixth course.
Ah, thank you very much. And you are? We're glad to have you. Nicole?
Yeah, I'm Nicole. I'm a fourth year med student. Actually, just found out today that I'm a ophthalmology at Penn, so I'm a little bit distracted.
Oh, congratulations.
I'm excited to hear there's so many healthcare policy people here in the class that I've been really interested in. So I'm going to be practicing ophthalmology in the future, and I decided to take mediation. Well, I'm an MBE student as well, but I decided to take the mediation course because I just feel like it's a really practical skill to have.
Excellent. And your name is?
I'm Chelsea. I literally just got registered yesterday, so my head is spinning. I have no background in law or medicine or anything, but I studied ethics in college. I was a philosophy student, so that was my concentration throughout college. So this was the next step. I had a prior career as a preschool teacher.
Oh, very good. Thank you.
Lots of mediation there, but.
Yes. I'm Shauna. I am a full-time MBE student, and I just applied to law school, so I guess that's my next step. And I think mediation is a perfect fusion of those two enterprises, so here we go.
Thank you.
I'm
Tania.
Yeah, you got it. Tania.
I'm corrigible.
I'm an MSW MBE dual degree student also. I'm interested in medical social work, so this is a perfect class for me to learn.
Excellent.
And to get a skill set that I think is great for.
Great. Terrific. David?
My name's Dave Hook. I finished my third year at Jefferson Medical College, took the year off to do this MBE full time. I actually did not take the intensive. So the project that I'm working on with you, I'm going to be learning about what it's all about.
Exactly.
We are doing this,
so. To just amplify on what David just said, there are a group, for the first time in a long, long time, of 8 new medical schools in the United States. Obviously, they didn't all get founded at the same time. But David is working with Art and Autumn and I in dealing with the consortium of new medical schools to consult and create and possibly also teach the ethics curriculum in or for those medical schools. We had no idea until we recently had a meeting, which David attended, that there was a consortium. In other words, it sort of took us by surprise that they were as connected as they are and sort of view the benefits of having some shared resources and from identifying themselves as doing some things that are deemed new and perhaps different from what the traditional schools do that might be a way of distinguishing them. So we're very enthusiastic about the reception that we got there. So that's what David is alluding to. Yes.
Hi, I'm Christina. I'm a second year graduate student in the School of Nursing and MBE student. My research interests very broadly are ethical issues related to end of life care. So I'm taking this course because I'm interested in decision making for families and caregivers and patients about life sustaining treatments.
Terrific.
I'm Dick Whittington. I'm in the program, but doing it on the 4-year plan, basically 1 quarter.
Okay, that's fine.
And I'm a radiation oncologist. I work in East Orange, New Jersey. And I was very interested in this course, especially because in 30 years of practice, it seems like most of the conflicts that I've run into have been people who really meant well, were motivated towards good ends, but unfortunately prioritized their virtues differently from the other people, which then led to conflict, loss of respect, and it seems like this is a way to really address the whole issue.
Well, we're glad to have you, Rich. And Katrina?
My name is Katrina. I'm a full-time MBE student, and I have a background in microbiology, and I'm looking at a career in public health. So this is a great practice for mediation and global public health issues.
Excellent.
Hi, I'm Kathy Lex. I'm a MBE student here. I'm also a senior program manager at the Penn Center for Neuroscience and Society. And what I'm hoping to take away from the course is a few ways to improve our community conferences.
Excellent.
I'm Lisa DeSouza. I'm a professor at the University. I'm a project manager in end-of-life care research. And that's why I'm interested in taking the course.
And where do you do the project management? Okay. Thank you. Yes.
I'm Julia. I'm a physical med student at Penn, and I'm considering doing the MBE along with my MBE, so I'm really excited about that, and I would love to be able
Excellent.
I'm Dan. I'm about halfway through the program. I'm a lawyer. I haven't really practiced. I'm trying to get back into that.
Very good. And you're still practicing? Wait, you're still?
I used to practice law. I stopped for about 5 years. And now
okay.
I finished this up. And get back into law.
Very good. Paula?
Hi. I've been in this program since last fall. For many years, I was here at the Health System and Public Affairs and decided to make a career change. And now I'm trying to find myself in bioethics somewhere. But I'm particularly moved by this class because many years ago, I was affected personally by illness in my family where there were two sides. There was a spouse and there were parents and they were fighting. And never knew about, or mediation was never presented to us. And if it had been, I think an outcome would have been very different. So I'm very interested in exploring what this means.
That's great. I hope this meets with your expectations. Mm-hmm. Yes?
I'm a third year and actually I'm in this class for professional examiners and a practitioner at the cardiac ICU at CHOP. And we certainly run into issues not only parent and caregiver, but also among the caregivers.
Okay. Thank you. Corbett?
Yeah, I'm Corbett. I'm a full-time MBA student. And I'm background in physics and I'm going to medical school in fall.
Very good. And last but not least, Steve.
So I'm a third-year med student at Penn. This is my third MBE course. I have some background in mediation in that I was a peer mediator in fourth and fifth grade. so that's where my expertise is.
That's a good, actually, precursor to this. My son was as well. but I'm again, I hope that we meet your expectations. And I'm Ed Bergman, obviously, and just to give you a sense of how I come to this, I'm a lawyer by education, and after about 15 years of practicing law, woke up one morning and said to myself, I think you're more a part of the problem than part of the solution. This may ring true with some of you other folks, and you indicated that you might anticipate some sort of thing like that. But in all seriousness, I really did begin to believe that very often the fact that we are such a litigious society and the nature of the formal traditional system of adjudication and litigation is so burdensome to the litigants, so costly and so time-consuming, that I often felt that, and you may have heard this before, but that it seemed as though it existed for the benefit of the lawyers, not for the litigants. And that sort of stimulated me to start reading everything I could about alternative dispute resolution. And did that while I was still practicing, and unbeknownst to me, when I was going to get my espresso in the morning on the way to work, I started to have a conversation about this, which then became the conversation that never ended every morning with another guy who was in the same place. And I didn't know that he was, in addition to being trained as a lawyer, that he was a professor at Princeton who did judicial philosophy and constitutional interpretation and various things of that sort. But we were engaged in this dialogue that lasted like for a year. And suddenly one day, we're in the middle of the conversation. We said, why are we having this conversation in a coffee bar alone? Why aren't we doing this in the context of a formal curriculum? So we went to the dean of the graduate program at the Woodrow Wilson School at Princeton, and I described what it is that I thought was something that could be done in a viable manner in the context of their public affairs program. And I won't say to my surprise, but to my delight, they said, that's unbelievable. You can do whatever you want. You want graduate students, you want undergraduate students, you tell me. So we taught an undergraduate policy conference at Princeton called Politics and the Courts, Alternate Means of Dispute Resolution. And then after that was successful, we went on to teach a graduate course to joint degree MP, what do they call it, MPAs, JDs, on alternative dispute resolution in complex public law cases. And soon after that, I began to realize that, unfortunately, there weren't many people at Princeton who really had a great deal of conversancy with the material that I was interested in. And so in talking to that same dean of graduate studies about that problem, he then referred me to somebody at the Wharton School. And I started to teach at the Wharton School in 1995, and I still teach there. But about 6 years ago, Art Kaplan and Autumn Feaster found me. It was a complex story, but they found me, and we began, in effect, the mediation program, which has now kind of grown from this course to incorporate 4 intensive courses a year and other initiatives, such as the one I talked about that David is involved in, which we hope over the course of the next several years will come to fruition. And at the same time, while I was teaching it, I also started to do some of it in a clinical context. Most of my law practice is as a mediator, so I mediate all the time. I don't really do much in the way of representative lawyering. I mediate. And I also now, of course, write and participate in, you know, other roles for somebody who would, in my position, such as being recently a member of the National Working Group for Training and Credentialing in Clinical Ethics. And Autumn and I are beginning the writing of a textbook on clinical, the use of mediation in the resolution of clinical healthcare disputes at the same time. So we have many sort of tentacles to this, and it's been, I think, very rewarding in many respects. I've enjoyed it immensely, and certainly my practitioner career is much more gratifying to me than when I was functioning as an advocate. And I think we'll have plenty of opportunity as the semester goes by to see maybe just why that is. All right? So let me start. Now, I don't know what they did about hooking me up to the projector, but...
She set up everything
there. Oh, what did she do?
She set up everything there so you could watch the clips on the screen.
Yeah, but how... the question, of course, is, well, where do we go?
You could escape and take it back to your desktop.
Escape.
Upper left-hand corner, keyboard.
Oh, okay. Oh, she's got the... No, these are the PowerPoints, so the question is where the film clips are stored.
Media.
Who? Any media geniuses here?
Right there.
Windows?
Windows Media.
Okay. We'll try it. All right, we can begin with this. That's perfectly fine. Well, that is to say, if we can get it to work.
The little arrow that...
What do we need to do?
Press the
arrow?
Blue one. Yeah.
Okay. As you'll see, I'm a computer nitwit. Not working. Oh, here we go. No.
The other mouse button.
The other one? Hit it again?
Right on the arrow.
There we go. All right.
So
can you
stop it and
do you want to start from the beginning?
Oh, yeah, well, we can go back.
Katrina.
All right. If somebody will do this for me, it would be great. Yeah, we, not only do we want to rewind, but if we can get slightly greater volume, that would be great too.
You can just drag the bar back to the beginning.
Oh, I can
drag
that.
It on the bottom.
Yeah.
And easier, probably. Also, what we really want to do is ultimately expand the picture to more of the screen, if we can do that as well.
You want to start here?
Yep. Whoop. Oops. You just lost something.
Right from the day we get up from our bed, until we go to bed, we are negotiating. Now, there's a very interesting story about a child. You know, he was very fussy. He wouldn't eat anything at the time of lunch or dinner. He would not really eat anything. So his father thought there was something wrong with his system, biological system. So he took him to the doctor. He had a friend, a doctor. He said, okay, no problem. These children are always like that. You have to keep your patience. You have to sort of cajole them, persuade them. And it takes some time. That's not difficult. He said, okay, you try it. So next day he came here, came to the clinic. Then he said, hello, how do you do? The child said, I'm fine. He said, I'm sure you must be hungry. He said, no, not at all. So he said, no, you must have something to eat. We'll have anything you choose. He said, okay, but there's one condition. He said, what is that? He said, you have to eat with me. He said, fine, I'll eat with you. Then he said, what would you like to have? He said, I would like to have a fried cockroach. He said, fried cockroach? I'm really serious. He said, I'm serious. He ordered his nurse, told, okay, you get a fried cockroach. Let us see who wins patients, who has motivation. So when the cockroach was served, he said, okay, you eat half, you have meat first. The doctor was very much, embarrassed. He said, okay, I'll have. He put the half and took it in his mouth. Then he said, now you eat. Then the child started crying. He said, why are you crying? He said, you ate my half.
Now, this took place in a workshop that I was teaching in Calcutta, India. And the reason I show it is to begin our discussion of negotiation with what I hope is, when you think about it, a self-evident fact, which is we're all negotiators, are we not? And don't we, in fact, like that clever kid who's the subject matter of this story, don't we all start to be negotiators when we're children? I mean, we negotiate with our parents, we negotiate with our siblings, we negotiate with our friends about everything from allowances or what movie do I want to see or where are we going on vacation or anything that you can think of. So the notion that the study and understanding of negotiation theory and practice is something that's reserved for professionals is a silly notion. What is kind of confounding is, given the ubiquity of negotiation in our lives and the extent to which we rely on the development of those skills, how few of us have any formal training in it. And what I like to say to my Wharton School students at the outset of a class is to make them realize that although in a negotiation course, we can help people to become better negotiators and perhaps the best negotiators they can be, at the end of the day, there is an element or a component of this skill that is perhaps not teachable. Meaning, it's like if we were a violin class and all of you were prospective professional violinists, and each and every one of you went home and practiced for 5 hours every day after class, at the end of the day, there probably would still be only one Yasha Heifetz at the end of the course or the end of the year or the end of whatever it is we were indulging in to try to improve our skills. So, again, one of the first things I want you to know as mediators as well as negotiators is that that is realistically, an aspect here. Not everybody in this room or not everybody in the world is necessarily cut out from a personality standpoint to be able to have the right kind of personality, mindset, approach, and skill set that's going to enable them to be gifted at this job of being a mediator. And yet, to the extent that all of you, and I hear from your comments, that almost all of you understand and believe that in your professional lives, an aspect of that professional life, at the very least, will involve mediation and negotiation, I think you owe it to yourselves to maximize the extent to which you can hone and form those skills, whether or not you're one of the very, very gifted ones. So it's not a competition to learn how to negotiate and mediate, except you're competing just with yourself. You're not competing with somebody else. You're trying to make as deeply as possible, an analysis of your own strengths and weaknesses in performing these roles so that you can work on maximizing and implementing the things that you're strong at while diminishing or improving the aspects of the role that you may not be as readily suited to. And again, this is all going to become more clear as we go on. Okay. Now, fundamentally, I want you to forget about medicine and clinical this, that. We're not at that point. We're, as I said to those who have been in the intensive, we're starting from scratch. We want to get certain senses under our belt of what the nature of negotiating means before we can even talk about what classical mediation looks like. So if you could get me the next film clip.
I think they're in a folder, right?
Over at the bottom, class one film clips.
You just passed.
Oh, okay.
I would rather have, let me just see, I'd like to have take the money and run. There it is. Can we blow it up to get it onto the...
Virgil attempts to change his life with one bone stroke.
Thank you.
Well, you'll have
forward if I can get you any money. Rush. What? Rush. I'm sorry, but that's not a policy. The gentleman in the gray suit.
That's G-Wing pointing. Yes, I am. I'm pointing a gun at you.
Gun?
That's G-Wing. Well, that's a B. That's a B. No, excuse me. That's
N. Frank.
I am pointing a gun at you. Apt natural.
No, that's
what
not.
Is apt?
Yeah, that's apt.
Oh, it couldn't be. That's a plain B.
No. I'm afraid not. That's apt natural.
Oh,
I'm pointing a gun at you.
Mr.
No,
Mellon.
I am pointing a gub. No, that's gun. That's G-U-N. That's gun. I am pointing a gun at you.
G-U-N.
Oh, no, it looks like a B, but it's an M.
Oh,
no, that's of course it is.
I see
it's a gun. No, it isn't.
That's
a gun.
Of
course
it
is.
It's
a gun. Yes, we discussed it. Just a short while ago.
We were there on the window, and it's gun.
If I put my ear, I would have touched it. Date today.
Okay, can you turn that off? Now, I hope that you can see from this clip that the reason that I play it is that negotiation cannot exist without the vehicle of communication, right? In other words, when we are negotiating, what we're doing to achieve the negotiation process or implement it is to communicate with one another. And therefore, things that jump to mind, clarity of communication, the fact that if I, as in the Woody Allen instance, as the sender, communicate with a lack of clarity or ambiguity, that you as the receiver are likely to understand what I said differently than I intended that you understand it. But similarly, if as the receiver of the communication, there is a defect in the communication that's more attributable to you because you are not apprehending the communication properly, to wit, you are not listening, and when we say listening in a negotiation and mediation context, we're talking about what the literature refers to as active listening. And active listening is the antithesis of casual listening. It means we are listening with such an attuned focus, not just to what the person is saying, but to their body language, to the inflections of speech, to the extent to which the speech embodies a signal that there may be an emotional component to what is being said. Whether the speaker is speaking with trepidation or with confidence or with bravado or all of those kinds of things, is there a time during which they are speaking when we can also notice that their leg is bouncing up and down or they're biting their nails or suddenly they have transitioned from looking you in the eye to looking over your shoulder or looking down at the desk or at their feet. Because all of those things can be meaningful to you in terms of your ability to take that signal, not necessarily attribute a particular meaning to it, but to understand that there may be material in there that's going to help you wonder about and maybe ultimately delve more deeply into the question of why is that happening? Why aren't they looking you in the eye? Why are they looking down? Why are they getting nervous every time the word, whatever, sandal comes up? I don't know where the hell I got that from, but you get what I mean. So active listening with all of your sensory apparatus to everything that is out there in the form of stimuli that might add more meaning and more depth to what it is that you're receiving by way of communication. All right, now let's see one more clip.
Perfect.
Let me have the defending your life.
This is the evening before Mr. Miller took the job of advertising and was cold until his passing. He asked his wife to help him by playing a little game. You remember, Mr. Miller? You asked to act the boss so you could sharpen your tools in order to get what you wanted.
Do this for me, it helps.
Not now, I
mean. Come on, do it.
What do you want me to do?
Begin.
Silly.
It's not silly, it helps me. Offer me $55,000, no more.
How much do you want?
How much are you offering me?
$55,000.
I can't work here for a penny under 65, I'm sorry.
Well, I can't pay you 65.
Then I can't work here.
58,000.
65.
59?
65.
60?
65.
61.
Let me make it plain. I cannot take the job for under 65, under no conditions.
Your Honors, I would like to go directly to the next afternoon and show you the real encounter.
Manio, I'm prepared to offer you $49,000.
I'll take it.
Let me get you a parking place.
Okay.
Why did you accept so much less money than you wanted and do it so quickly?
Here we go again, money. Obviously, this is all about money. Look, I'm guilty. I didn't make enough money, okay? Call me a hippie, send me to hell. I give up.
You keep thinking it's about money, but it's about fear. Why didn't you stand up to your boss the way you did to your wife? What happened in your mind?
Well, first of all, it wasn't my wife. It was a man with a suit, and the suit had an odor. The owner said $49,000. I like that very much.
It somehow got stuck.
This is the evening before Mr. Miller took the job of advertising. Oh. He was told until his passing. He asked his wife to
and maybe
help
it went
him
on to the drive.
Do you remember Mr. Miller?
Okay, that's all right. We can stop this. All right. Whatever you want. Just stop. So, it is absolutely fundamental to understand that not only with negotiation, but in your role as mediators, whatever the context, that it is absolutely normal that you would be confronting and experiencing yourself anxiety in relation to the negotiating context, because most of us, first of all, have been brought up to think about negotiation, well, from what we see in the movies and on television. And in fact, at least in my experience, when you learn that through the mass media, what you usually learn is kind of a model of the hard-nosed negotiator who sort of swallows the other person for breakfast, you know, the chew them up and spit them out thing. And that kind of model obviously brings with it a particular sense of the trepidation that one ought to feel before going into combat with another person to see who's going to win the negotiation. Now, we're going to learn, of course, that there are other models of negotiation and negotiating behavior. But in fact, many, many times, and particularly since when you go into a negotiation situation, particularly with people who you don't know well, you haven't had experience with, or you go into a place that is unfamiliar to you, heaven forbid a hospital, you're going to feel displaced and uncomfortable. And you're going to feel that your ability to negotiate in a comfortable, calm, collected way may well be compromised. So as mediators or prospective mediators, it behooves you to understand that very often one of the phenomena that you're going to be dealing with is dealing with other people's anxiety number one, and how you might best approach putting them at ease. But also, simultaneously, you cannot assume that even though you're intelligent, experienced people who have been, as they say, around the block, although some of you haven't been around that many blocks yet, that you're going to be without anxiety in your role as a mediator. Because you're going to be, as just perfectly naturally, you're going to be concerned, am I doing a good job? Am I being articulate? Am I being clear? Are there triggers in this situation, whether it's, for example, as I said, a hospital, or a person who looks very threatening, foreboding, that make you kind of shaking in your boots, when in fact you know that in order to be able to do a good job, you need the opposite. You need to be on a very even keel, thinking straight, and so forth, so that you're going to have to be able to learn to deal with anxiety, both on the part of third persons, but also on the part of yourself, okay? So now we've looked at two very fundamental pieces of the sort of generic issues in negotiation, communication, and anxiety. But let's continue. So if I could see the next. Will you give me devil's advocate?
Jacksonville DA's office.
64 straight convictions. What a number!
I like to be in court. I didn't plea out a lot.
Well, what's that like? One day you're putting them away, next day you're setting them free.
Takes a little getting used to.
Pays better though, doesn't it?
Yes, it does.
That math teacher, the Geddes case. Now, I hear you were brilliant.
Prosecutor dropped the ball.
Really? So you think your guy was guilty?
I didn't say that.
No, what'd you say?
How's this? I began the case with a clear conscience.
I was sure you had a secret.
The men's room. Upstairs, men's room, the Duval County Courthouse, there's a hole in the wall straight through to the next room. I spent 5 years listening to juries deliberate. Love it all you want, just don't repeat it. I'm not sure the Florida Bar Association would appreciate it.
My lips are sealed. You don't really want to go back to Florida, though, do you? Walk with me. Can't handle it.
It's peaceful.
My my sentiments exactly. So fill in the resume for me. Tell me, your family, your father, what does he do?
I never got to know my father. He passed away before I was born. My mother raised me. Just the two of us.
She never remarried?
She wasn't married the first time.
Well, that can't be easy in a town like Gainesville, can
it? I don't think it's easy anywhere. Holy shit.
Little different when you're looking down, isn't it?
Yes, it is. Oh, my God.
Your mother. What's she like?
She's a preacher's daughter. She's tough. She's worked in the same poultry plant for as long as I can remember. She's got a church she really likes, so she's usually either there or they go out. They do a lot of volunteer work.
Behold, I send you out as sheep amidst the wolves.
So they say.
Didn't her off? The book? The church?
No, I'm on parole. Early release for time served.
A lot of potential clients down there.
Are we negotiating?
Always.
Can I ask you a question then? Why do you need a criminal department?
Our clients break the law like anyone else. Just tired of sending their business across the street.
You offering me a job?
I'm thinking about it. I know you got talent. I knew that before you got here. It's just the other thing I wonder about.
What thing is that?
Pressure. Changes everything, pressure. Some people, you squeeze them, they focus. Others fold. Can you summon your talent at will? Can you deliver on a deadline?
When do we talk about money?
Money? Yeah. Well, that's the easy part.
Okay. So, having learned previously about the fact that negotiation is founded on communication, one of the things that this clip teaches us, and we could talk about this clip for a long time, it's basically a primer, but I'm going to narrow my focus here and suggest a couple of things to you, which is, number one, did you notice that in the dialogue between Pacino and Keanu Reeves that frequently the Pacino character knew the answers to the questions that he was posing to the Reeves character? Now, that's important. And the reason it's important is because of the following. Just as communication is the way we implement negotiation, what we sometimes call the currency of negotiation is information. So the gathering and processing of information is an enormous part of the negotiation process. And we generally implement that aspect of the negotiation process in a couple of different ways. And they're both evident here. The first is preparation. Usually, people who negotiate are more successful if they're better prepared than the other person. In other words, again, the anomaly between this sort of mass view of the sort of hotshot negotiator who comes in shooting from the hip, and it's all about how he or she knows how to ad-lib and just get the job done and run roughshod over everybody. The fact of the matter is that in most kinds of negotiation, in law, in business, and so forth, the people who are the best at it are also the people who do the best and most thorough preparation. that wins the day, if you will. I'm not saying to win the negotiation. That makes you, your likelihood of being effective much greater than if you are unprepared. Now, preparation can be done in many ways. Reading, looking at prior instances of a situation similar to what you're confronting on any given time, learning the history of the parties, etc., etc. All of that kind of stuff that gets done before the negotiation proper even starts. But then when the negotiation actually commences, we have to do more than just rely on our preparation. We have to continue to probe, right? And we probe by primarily asking questions. And some of those questions, not all of them, should be questions that we know the answer to in advance, for the simple reason that, what? Why would I want to ask questions that I know the answer to? Yes?
See if the other person, if you know the answer, you could see if the other person's lying.
What's one possibility is that I know the answer, I ask the question, I get the wrong answer back. She could be lying, or she could not know what the hell she's talking about. All extremely useful for me to know. You will also notice that in that interface between those two characters, there were times in which the air was filled with nothing but silence. Inexperienced negotiators can't handle silence. And what they do is they fill up the space and they start blurting out things. And lots of times, what they blurt out is stuff that you really want to know, and they might not tell you if you ask them a direct question, but we're just out of the sheer tension of having to break that silence, they may tell you things that you wouldn't otherwise learn. Similarly, when you are probing and asking questions as a negotiator, you do the flip side of what I just described, and that is, in addition to asking pointed questions, you ask open-ended questions. Open-ended questions also give you the opportunity to kind of get a Rorschach-y kind of response from the other party, which again may go well beyond what you could have gotten if you simply directed them into a narrowly channeled inquiry. So it is that ability to kind of create the appropriate and relevant admixture of pointed questions and open-ended questions that make you effective in the probing aspect of negotiations. We'll see later that in the modern notion of the creation of physician-patient relationships, ones in which fundamentally the model that's used to create the physician-patient relationship is a negotiation model. And what is it becomes incumbent on the physician to do is to be able to implement those methodologies, including the open-ended questions. But we're not up to that point. We're taking baby steps. One more, please. And now if I could have, be cool.
This could be ugly.
managers and producers at FMDs.
Tommy own money?
I would say yes.
Tiffany, man the phones. Hi, get in the office. Look like you know what you're doing. Edie, I want you behind the desk. You're still the boss. These guys need to see that NTL is still in business.
Okay. Where should I hide the books?
Leave them on the desk. And whatever you do, don't mention the Russians.
Enjoyed that story, Edie. I mean, Russians are Russians.
I know it's hard, but...
I'm a highly educated man. Sincerely, you don't expect me to believe a story about some Russians. Now, I suggest that you open up those books or things gonna get real ugly up in here.
Sen, the books are none of your business. You'll get the money when NTL has it.
Double.
Pop me's not gonna do you any good. But if you wait till Friday, I get you your money plus the vape.
Plus the vape. All right. All right. Okay. Everybody cool now. Everybody calm down. Dabu, calm down. Calm down. Just wait. So you're saying plus the vape.
Plus the vape.
Tommy Athens, if you get what I'm saying.
I feel you.
You feel
player.
Okay. Now, here's the core issue that's raised by this clip. You heard Travolta indicating that he knows who Sin is. Highly educated man, Ivy League guy, Wharton degree, so forth. But obviously, Sin LaSalle wants to be perceived in a different way. He wants to be perceived as a street guy who goes around with his wife's cousin packing and intending to kill people if they don't make the payment. Now, he has no intention of killing anybody, right? As we can see. We can see that Dabu, or whatever his name is complaining that he's never gotten to kill anybody. Now, the point is that in negotiation, perception is everything. Perception is reality. And that's why, guys, if you look at this clip and juxtapose it with the last one, what you see is something of core importance, and that is, it is the preparation and the probing that you utilize in order to, instead of presuming that what you perceive to be true is in fact reality and true, you're testing it to see if there's a gap between objective reality and perception. The people who don't do that are often operating under illusions and false premises. So if we could go back to the last clip with Al Pacino, when Reeves walks into that office, it is pretty clear from his demeanor that he assumes and perceives that that law firm is wealthy, very successful, and in a position to offer him a great job for a ton of money if he wants to take it. Let me change the facts a little bit. Suppose we run a Dun & Bradstreet report on that law firm, and we find out that all of the furniture is rented and they're 3 months behind on the payments. Suppose we find out that unless they achieve X, Y, and Z improvement in their cash flow, they're going to be kicked out because it's a rental, not a thing that they own, and they're going to lose that place. Now, if any of those things are true, the way they handle any number of personal and professional situations is going to be different, because what they're going to need to do is behave in a way that gets them to generate as much immediate cash as they can in order to make up for those deficits that they have. And so in consequence, if, for example, you were to come in and be a client of that firm might well have a tendency to look to settle your case more quickly but for less money than they might if it were the case that they had plenty of cushion in their current cash flow, right? And so again, the way in which you create the ability to close the gap between perceived and objective reality is by doing all of that unearthing of the information that you need to be in the best place you can be from the standpoint of the acquisition of information. It's often said in negotiation that information is power, okay? And in some real sense, it is power. All right, let's take a 10-minute break, and then we'll come back and move on to a little bit of the anatomy of what we call distributive negotiation. Thank you. Did everybody sign the new student? Thank you. I'm not sure.
Thank you for doing this.
Come on.
It was
awesome.
For that.
For, yeah.
Well, I'm sleeping
with Diane.
I muscles
get tired.
Yeah.
I see our clock isn't working, so I have to rely on that.
Are there
more
facilities?
So,
I don't think he had any more copies.
Shift to the PowerPoints.
Okay.
Is that good?
Yeah. You don't mind doing it?
No.
You know, the problem is I think it takes time for it to warm up.
Oh, yeah.
So it's, you know, I'll just have to tolerate it.
Okay.
Or bob and weave.
Hi.
Well, I'm not sure. Let's see. It's now 10 to 6. If we start at 6, I'll try to get you out a little early, but if not, you have to go.
I'm just going to sit right here, and
okay,
I'll probably
cool.
leave. I just want to let you know.
Okay, I appreciate that.
I wanted to
yes.
ask a very similar question. I have a class at the law school that starts at 7 o'clock.
Okay.
And I'm not very quick these
I
days.
I can see that.
So I'm going to have to leave
okay.
from now on. I don't know, maybe you go until 7 normally, right?
Yeah.
Okay, so I would have had to run anyway.
Well, again, it's no problem at all in any of these classes where we're not doing games. And most of the time, even when we're doing games, we'll be in a debriefing mode
or
by the time
right.
you leave.
Okay.
And my only concern is if we are, if you're actually doing
if
mediation.
If my group happens to be
yeah,
last.
And you're not done.
Is it possible for my group to always go not last? Or is it
oh, no, they do the simultaneously.
Oh, we simultaneously.
Yeah, you're in different groups and working simultaneously.
Oh, if my
so,
group is not done.
Yeah. And if since we don't know the exact number of people in the class, there are at times games in which we may have to, because of the unevenness of the numbers in relation to the number of roles, have multiple people playing the same role. If you were a multiple party, then you could go anyway, but you can't sort of walk out in the middle. You know what I'm saying? I don't think it'll happen much, but I just want you to be aware of that.
I'm trying to get the van. It takes sometimes a half hour for it to arrive, so I never really know when it's going to arrive. I'm going to have to call, well, I'll step out to call.
Okay. Okay.
And then when it arrives, I'm thinking maybe to leave at 6:50.
Yeah.
So
I mean,
and then I'll be late
I,
to my next class.
Okay.
Instead.
Okay. Let's do it that way, and I don't think we're going to run into
okay.
many problems, if any.
Okay.
Right.
I was going to have to ask you anyway, but now I really have to ask you.
I can see that.
So
which class is it?
It's actually Professor Diamond's negotiations class.
Oh, really?
Yes.
Yeah,
so
oh,
thought,
that's
oh,
great.
Is this who he's talking about?
Okay,
yeah,
cool.
So I'll have the clinical aspect and the, I guess, the business or legal. I don't know how
yeah,
he's going to teach it.
I assume, well, he's teaching at the law school.
He's teaching at the law school.
Okay,
but it's the same course he teaches at Wharton.
He teaches at Wharton, yeah.
So,
right.
Yeah.
Well, I don't know. He may adjust somewhat for the law school or may
right.
not.
Right,
may
not. But it's the same thing where it's interactive there and it's interactive here. And
yeah.
I'm kind of like, I don't
right.
want to be late
that,
to
that's a problem.
Or early.
All right. I don't think it's going to be a huge problem.
Okay.
I really
and
don't.
Then I'll make a phone call probably at some point.
Go ahead, anytime.
Thank you.
Hi.
Hi. So, the intensive starts tomorrow.
The intensive start? Are you in the intensive?
I
too?
Am.
Okay. Starts tomorrow morning at 9 or a little before.
Okay.
Okay.
And do we need to bring
really,
no,
I'm trying to think.
Set.
You,
oh, that,
well,
don't
you were, I think, asked to leave.
Yeah, I'm trying. I'm trying.
Well,
I didn't see anything on the blackboard saying.
No? Maybe I'm wrong.
I didn't know. I would notice that so much.
Let me see if I can. I'm going to do this in my office. In any event, it's too late for it to be an issue. And don't worry, because you can always catch up if it was. I really don't recall. I thought He had asked me to read a couple of things. You know, we'll see. All right. So you take, I'm glad you're doing both at once.
Yeah.
Blitzkrieg.
It seems really interesting. I'm trying to do the whole program in 1 year.
Are you really? Good for you.
Yeah.
Excellent. All right. Well, I'm glad we'll be seeing a lot of each other.
Yeah. And the binders.
Oh, yeah.
I
think what Nora Morales said, you can just write down a piece of paper saying your name and how much you owe, and then you can bring it the next time.
Yeah, it's a lot.
So, in fact, let me
announce. Should we take
if, yeah, if anybody needs, could I just have your attention for a second? If anybody needs the Dubler and Liebman book, they're here, and if you don't have a check for the little amount that you have to pay for it, you can just give me a slip and say Nancy Jones owes whatever it is. Yeah, and you can just take it. Yeah, no, don't worry. But just make sure you give me a piece of paper, you know, with your name on it, and then I'll tell Nora and Robin who owes what.
So sorry, I just missed that. So
take it and just give me a piece of paper saying that you're all.
I'll get you the summary probably by tomorrow. Okay, and then you can do that. You'll make a change to send it out there.
Yeah.
I'm trying to put everyone, who was in attendance in their official title, so I know affiliation program here.
Here.
Yeah, if you have, I didn't want to just put, you know, attorney down. Is there anything that's appropriate in the list?
I think I did.
Bioethics, and do you want me to list anything from the report?
I'm also a lecturer in the Department of Legal Studies and Business Ethics.
Oh, no, I'm sorry. It's
going to help all I suppose just wanted to make sure I know I'm going to have to play.
Are you ready in IOU?
Yes, playing.
It's $15, but you can't leave cash.
Yeah, I
took it with me. My problem too. I'm like, I brought cash. Yeah.
Maybe to check
them. Yeah.
Okay. I'll probably know by tomorrow in March.
Okay.
March. So.
Cool.
Okay.
All right. Just let me know.
Okay. Great. Thank you.
All right. That's good.
I wondered if you had an extra.
You know, I gave out all my extras, but why don't you just grab one from somebody I gave it to? And just take it. I mean, if there's a copy machine.
They're on the blackboard, too.
There. Oh,
gotcha. You can print it from there. That's what I did. But yeah, go ahead.
Every IRB is different. Yeah, I mean, Penn's IRB. I already have an IRB at Penn. And even the Philadelphia IRB has revenue from the IRB in East Orange. I mean, it seems like they sort of grow their own plan based on the resources and the interest and also the level of research. I think it actually is potentially a strength, but also potentially a flaw because you do risk. I mean, there are certain the bare bones things about who you have to have and how many people have to be there and that sort of thing. And the mix of researchers and researchers. It's pretty basic. But then the IRB itself can develop its own sense of rigor. And they're rigorous about different things, which is a potential strength, but they can not be rigorous about what's going to be within the rules. The IRB is very rigorous as far as science, as far as science, and the specification of the biological avoidance of mismanagement. The IRB didn't emphasize that so much, it's sort of intuitively investigated, but they really obsessed over the
the
veteran is there getting care for free because he's a family.
This is your IOU pile.
Okay. That's great. It's an interesting way of dealing with course materials, isn't it? I owe you.
Here's another one.
Thank you very much.
I'm also suspicious because I think that the tend to be too much.
Are you teaching any classes that were in this semester?
This past semester.
Oh, you did? Do you teach second years, like electives? Or?
I was teaching undergraduate upperclassmen, mostly juniors and seniors. Yeah. Are you?
No, I'm not at Wharton. My husband is now.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah.
So. Is in the MBA program?
Yeah.
Okay. Is he enjoying it so far?
Yeah, he likes it, I think. He's been doing a lot of job stuff, so.
Good.
Busy, but, you know.
What was he doing before he enrolled?
He was in the Marines, actually.
Oh, really?
Yeah, he was an intelligence officer in the Marines.
Interesting. So,
kind of a career change, but.
What, was he in any battlefield situation?
He went to Iraq, but he was, because he was, like, intelligence, he kind of did a behind-the-scenes sort of thing, you know?
Sure.
So, a little more protected, I guess.
Yeah, thankfully.
Not, like, breaking down doors or anything, you know?
Nonetheless, did he come into contact with gunfire?
Not too much, I don't think. So, when he was over there, it was a little bit later, so.
I'm glad for him and for you.
It was short-lived, so he's glad to be out, I think.
Excellent. All right, guys, can we get started so we can get out at a reasonable hour? PowerPoint. Class 1 PowerPoint, I guess. I didn't realize that was a separate option, but that's fine. Where are they? Ah, okay. Oh. Oops. To add title? When are we? I don't want to add a title. I just want to go forward.
Or we can either click on the next slide or.
Yeah, then we can put that on. Okay. And let's blow it up. And now I think we should be able to just use arrows to move them, no?
Oh, wait, it doesn't go too.
Actually, if you go over just where it says draw, just above there where you see like a little projector screen. That'll bring up the full screen.
Where is that at? Where
do you think? Over the lower left hand corner.
Yeah.
It says draw.
Oh.
Right above there, there's like a projector screen.
Oh,
here's extra copies of the syllabus.
Right there.
Oh, thanks very much. That's great.
A little more. I see what right there. Yes.
Anybody else need a syllabus? Yep. Here we go.
Thanks so much.
You're welcome. And here, if anybody wants one, I got them. More?
Pass a couple along over there.
You need one over
this
there?
One. There you go. Need more?
Yeah. Okay, one more.
There you go.
All right.
So thank you. No problem. Okay, we all set to go? All right. And now with the benefit of our discussion from the first part of class and those film clips, again, I thought it might be appropriate after what we discussed before about the fact that, in fact, negotiation has to be child's play. I thought this was an interesting picture that I got from a magazine, that negotiation isn't child's play. But, in fact, of course, it's both not child's play and it is child's play, the not child's play meaning that it is often seen as a very intimidating endeavor. Now, this is one among many definitions of negotiation, a joint decision-making process through which two or more interdependent parties seek to resolve a dispute or create a shared vision, notwithstanding the existence of conflicting interests. So the first thing that jumps out for me is the notion that for us to have a meaningful negotiation of any kind, we have to be interdependent. In other words, to take the simplest possible example, if I'm a buyer and you're a seller, and all you have to sell is a ring that I have a zero interest in, there wouldn't be any point in our negotiating. And in fact, if you had nothing to sell, there wouldn't be any point in my negotiating with you. So the interdependency is absolutely required for there to be a negotiation that makes any sense. And I think that's important to think about, remembering that there is, in fact, a relationship underlying the negotiation, even if it's as thin as the simple dyad of buyer, seller, I want it, you want to sell it. How, the question becomes, how much I'm going to pay for it. That's a pretty thin basis for a relationship, but it still reflects an interdependency. The second part of this definition that's important is that it's not always the case that negotiation is used to resolve disputes, meaning when you are using negotiation to create a shared vision, and let me just give you an example of what I mean by a shared vision. In a legal or business context, we're creating a partnership, and we need to flesh out the terms under which we will partner. That's, we're creating a shared vision, a joint venture to put a space station up between Russia and the United States, creating a shared vision, an environmental situation in which we're trying to figure out how to accommodate all of the various interested parties' concerns regarding generating energy in the building of a dam. Not, all of these might occur, these negotiations, before and or in the absence of a dispute, but we're negotiating a blueprint, in effect, for the future. Now, looked at in a certain way, that kind of negotiating to create a shared vision might also be termed dispute prevention, right? In other words, that might be synonymous with dispute prevention, because if we say we want to be partners and here's how we will run our relationship as partners, if we follow the terms that we agreed to in creating the shared vision, the underlying assumption is that we're not going to have to resolve the dispute unless and until the what was agreed to comes off the rails and that negotiated relationship goes awry. Okay? So again, I don't care whether you frame it in terms of creating a shared vision or you frame it in terms of attempting to prevent disputes by putting in place the various parties' responsibilities and rights, they're very related, if not identical. Now, a lot of these concepts that I have on the next slide, we've already talked about in connection with the videos that I showed. But I want to elaborate on a couple of the ones that we didn't talk about. And one of them is this notion of rapport building. I think it goes without saying that if two or more parties are attempting to negotiate with one another, regardless of what the subject matter of the negotiation is, it is probably more likely to be a successful encounter if prior to the start of the negotiations, the parties have established a rapport between one another. And the reason for that is multifaceted. One of the reasons why rapport building is important is that in the psychology literature, we know that the data suggests that when people are more alike one another, that they, in fact, also like the other person better and find a greater comfort level dealing with the other person, therefore making it easier to establish trust. Okay? So that's one reason for rapport building. Obviously, rapport building can also serve us well in reducing some of the anxiety that we talked about as being a potential peril in a negotiation situation. So that's important. And in fact, in building that rapport, it is also more likely to be the case that you will be able to carry the initiative from that rapport building from one step to another. For example, if I begin my negotiation with you by introducing myself in a gracious way and just telling you who I am, nice to meet you, blah, 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 okay, fine. And then we start identifying things that we have in common. Well, the things that we have in common might, in addition to invoking the so-called liking rule, also end up being substantively relevant to the negotiation. That is to say, we are both somewhat expert in A or B, which may make us believe that we can use our sort of joint expertise to work together to solve a problem. Now, we talked about perception, information, interdependency, communication, probing, and active listening. So I wanted you to have this slide because I think after having talked about it and seen it in action in a sort of real, you know, in a film context, it's going to be much easier for you to remember these things. And when I say remember them, not talking about, and this will be true of everything in this class, remembering isn't a matter of learning lists and feeding them back to me or to yourself. Ultimately, you will get the most out of this kind of education to the extent that you internalize these concepts, that they become part of who you are and you utilize them as sort of self-reference points as you begin to do the exercises and simulations. Because obviously, it's fine to talk about all of this stuff, but let's face it, when you're actually in a mediation or a negotiation, you don't really have the time to sit there and say, what did he say in class two? Or what did it say in that book that I just read? What you really need to do is understand these things to the point where you have a working knowledge and use of these concepts to the point where they're second nature to you, okay? Can you press the next slide, please? Now we're gonna talk a little bit about what the rudimentary negotiation literature looks like. And again, we're doing this very quickly and just brushing over it, but I think it's important for you to know it exists. And when we talk about a distributive bargain, this is what we're talking about. A fixed pie, what I get, you don't get, commonly referred to as win-lose, as opposed to win-win, and commonly associated with, but not limited to, single-issue bargaining over price. So let's go back to the fundamental, simplest example. It's the buyer and the seller negotiating over the sale of car, ring, house, it doesn't matter what it is. And the only issue is, what will that willing buyer pay that willing seller for that item? And that is what the fixed pie, what I get, you don't, refers to. Meaning, in that bilateral price-based negotiation with a single element to the bargaining mix, it's clear that every extra dollar I get is the seller is a dollar that you, the buyer, don't have, and vice versa, right? So that's what we mean by the fixed pie. There is this finite universe that represents the subject matter of the negotiation, and the idea of the negotiation is to see who gets the most of it. And that's the kind of negotiation that from the standpoint of structure and modality is consistent with what we talked about before, which is what you learn from watching the movies and television, which is I'm going to get everything and I'm gonna, you know, just blow you out of the water and walk away with everything, and that makes me a good negotiator and it makes me win. Okay? And this is, again, none of this is new to you because you see this all the time, and in fact it's what most people think about when they think of negotiation. Although I hope you will see in short order, maybe not this week, but next week, that is a hasty assumption and not one that really holds up when we talk about what happens in the world of contemporary negotiation, be it in the legal world, the business world, or in the clinical context. Can I go to the next slide, Katrina? So here are some terms that you might want to be at least somewhat conversant with. In a distributed negotiation, the resistance points, which are also synonymous with the term reservation prices, meaning they're one and the same, resistance points and reservation prices, refer to the most that a buyer will pay and the least that a seller will ultimately accept, meaning it's another way of describing what is usually referred to as the bottom line. The bargaining range, or the zone of possible agreement, that's what ZOPA is the difference between the buyer's and the seller's resistance points. Right? So, in other words, if you are rational people in possession of the facts, you can't come to me and tell me that you've reached an agreement that's outside the zone of potential agreement. Because in order to do that, you will either have engaged in a communication that is faulty or defective, or you will have misinterpreted the meaning of a resistance point, your own or the other party's. And that is something that's important simply for the following reason. In the real world, as opposed to in a classroom, part of the point in distributed bargaining is to try to dissuade the other party from the notion that their resistance point is what they say it is. So in other words, if you came in as a potential buyer of my house and you said, well, you normally, first of all, you wouldn't reveal your resistance price. But if I were to determine or guess that your resistance price was $400,000, to the extent that I could make you believe that you had come to that conclusion erroneously because you didn't know certain things about the condition of my house, or you didn't know certain things about comparable sales in the last week that nobody ever revealed to you, or you didn't know that this was the only house that was within X thousand yards of public transportation to the school that your kids want to go to, or any other thing that might ultimately disabuse you of the original notion. That happens in the real world. When you're in a classroom and you're given a simulated problem, not that this model is going to be particularly apposite to what we do, either in this class or in your lives. You still need to know about it because it is an alternative to what you in fact will be, I hope, doing, that in classrooms when you do those kinds of things, you're very frequently told what the resistance price is, or the reservation price, and the resistance point, and you therefore can't waver from it. You can't dissuade the other person and make them. But in the real world, in distributive negotiations, you're really doing what is often referred to as managing impressions. It's managing the other party's impressions of the value of the subject matter of the negotiation, right? And clearly you can do that in many ways, through persuasion, through the use of, we'll see, in fact, if, let me jump down to anchors. There are two ways to use the term anchors that are relevant to negotiation. The most common is that when I refer to an anchor, I'm talking about a reference to something that is outside, extrinsic to the negotiation, that I want to use in order to support the fact that my assessment of the value of the subject matter is more correct than yours. So for example, I might go, if I'm trying to sell Nicole my car, I might go to a blue book and show her that the average price for a 1996 Rolls Royce is X, even though she came in prepared only to pay X minus 10. But she might still be persuadable that her assessment was wrong if I have powerful anchors to support my attempt to persuade her and manage her impression. The same thing is true of any kind of reference book, article, statement by people of purported expertise, and so forth, that you can allude to, including past analogous events in which that occurred. Again, as I said, you just found out that there was a similar transaction yesterday in which the subject matter of the negotiation was valued at higher than that prospective buyer's initial resistance point is. And so what happens very frequently is that the parties to a negotiation will bring forth different anchors to support their respective positions. And you know, that can be any kind of anchor. That could also be that I get an expert to opine on the point of view that I believe is the one that should prevail in the negotiation about the valuation of one or another term within this bargaining mix. But you go out and you get another expert who opines to the contrary. And if you think about it, you already know this, because when you see litigation portrayed again in the media or you read about it, what happens, and this is true in medicine, I say X and you say Y, and I get a world-renowned expert from HUP and you get one from Columbia. And they both have impeccable credentials and they both testify to precisely the opposite things, which is not necessarily a function of the fact that they are either not experts or that they're not telling the truth. What it may often be a function of is the fact that many aspects of life, including many aspects of medicine, are possessed of uncertainty, and there are multiple points of view about precisely the same fact situation. Now, when we talk about BATNAs, bless you, BATNA is an acronym for the best alternative to a negotiated agreement. And the reason the BATNA is important is because, all other things being equal, you will be unlikely to agree to a negotiated resolution that gives you fewer benefits than what you could already get as an alternative to that negotiated agreement, right? In other words, if I already have a buyer who's willing to pay me $450 and Nicole is stuck on the $400 she's offering me, without there being further complexity to the conundrum that we're talking about, I'm not going to take her $400 when I have your $450. And so I may, in fact, use, both with the other party, but also with either of you, the notion of this BATNA is something that is going to make me feel that I have greater leverage in the negotiation, because I know that in fact I can get $450. So if you don't offer more than $450, I'm likely to walk away. And the ability to walk away is another definition for power or leverage in the negotiation. If you can walk, you've got the power. If you don't need it, right? And so that's also what we mean by outcome values when we talk about negotiation. That is, how important is it for me to consummate this negotiation and have it come to fruition? If in fact I need it more than you do, or more quickly than you do, once again, that's going to put you in a position of power and leverage, and me at a deficit in that regard, because I can't afford to walk away as readily as you can, since I don't have a powerful or strong BATNA. The concept of concessions in negotiation is also very important for interesting reasons, and that is, again, we know from the data in a lot of psychological research that, amazingly enough, people who bargain do not feel gratified or satisfied, regardless of how good the outcome is or in whose favor it is, unless they have literally gone through the exercise of receiving concessions from the other party. So you see, you might end up with a objectively less positive outcome, but feel better about it because the other party had started at point A and made numerous concessions to the point where your perception is that they conceded so much that it gives you this warm and fuzzy feeling that you got a good deal. And your having that warm and fuzzy feeling is what leads to your saying, fine, I'll do it. That's fine, I want that. The bargaining mix refers to the number of issues that are being negotiated. So I've always been, till now, talking to you about this absolutely simplest form of bargaining, bilateral, single issue, money. But in fact, in most negotiations, in the real world, and particularly in the 20th and 21st century, that's fairly rare. That single issue distributive bargain is really based on kind of the paradigm of the Turkish bazaar. Really, isn't it the case that it's only when I come in and create a bargaining relationship with another individual with whom I anticipate no further contact or relationship that all of the elements of distributive bargaining and the attempt
to acquire most of the value without reference to anything else like, gee, what is that likely to do with her dealing with me in the future? What is that likely to say about her feelings about whether I'm honest? What is that likely to do with what she's going to say to other people about what it was like to deal with Ed Bergman? And how is that going to affect Ed Bergman's reputation if, in fact, she does say that to those other people? So it ramifies, and the idea of the incident in buying the rug in the Turkish bazaar strikes me as being absolutely marginal in the world of complex business or even personal negotiations in the modern world. Even if you only look at it from the standpoint of mobility, technology, the existence of computers and information technology, it's no longer the case that if I sell you my car, even that narrow a transaction doesn't mean that when I leave after I sell the car to move to California, that I don't find that your sister lives next to me in San Diego, right? Or that there is some other person in our common network of acquaintances that learns of these dealings, particularly if there's going to be comment forthcoming about your dissatisfaction with the way I behaved in that negotiation context. Now that's not even the strong part of the argument. Strong part of the argument, as you will see, is it that in the modern world, and this cuts across all kinds of spheres of human endeavor, that relationships are actually paramount, and that you're not just talking about avoiding the negatives of commentary about you that might have a negative impact on your reputation, but you're talking about negotiating in part to create or preserve the relationship that exists between you and the person with whom you're negotiating. Meaning, I'm not going to screw you today if it means that you won't do business with me tomorrow and the next day. And in fact, the idea of getting the lion's share of the value of the transaction may be antithetical to what I need to do in order to strengthen my relationship with you. And so the idea of negotiation being solely about short-term transaction-based gain, as opposed to balancing long and short-term benefits of negotiation, is very not only short-sighted, but again, it's really inapposite to what we are doing most of the time in our lives in this era. I think there's another. No, okay, good. Yes.
I'm sorry.
Tell me what you mean by not being the primary negotiator.
So I'm a nurse practitioner. So typically, if you have a discussion with the family about the DNR,
right.
And you know, there are certainly the surgeons sometimes are really hard to give up a
you know, with time.
Yep.
Or you have an uneducated family who doesn't really understand all of the aspects.
Sure.
So it seems like it's weighted on the side of the physician versus the family. Just, yep. You know, you want those two, you want it to be equal and you want the outcome to be good, but you're identifying some very critical points on that, that
absolutely.
The relationship is broken if the family comes away saying, I don't think you really made the right decision, but I believe the care providers are pushing this into this
right. I think the question you're asking is a great question, but I'm hoping that that's what we're here to learn over the semester. If I were to attempt to answer it now, I would be giving you probably a very misleading, incomplete, non-comprehensive response. In other words, we're going to be starting even from next week when we're still dealing with negotiation. We're going to be moving from a discussion of this distributive model. The next step is to learn about what we call integrative negotiation, or what is sometimes called principled negotiation, or sometimes called interest-based negotiation, depending upon which writers and theoreticians that you're talking about. But that would be sort of the first step in dealing with the problem that you're raising. So, you know, we'll see. I mean, I don't think you'll be disappointed and feel that you didn't get your question answered, but that's a biggie. I mean, that's what we're here for. Anybody else have any comments or questions? Yes?
I am struck because I was in event planning and sales for
okay.
a long time,
yep.
and all of this is like,
right on point.
Just
right.
It never clicked in, I guess, but the one thing that I was thinking about is when you were talking about resistance points,
yep.
the thing that they taught us in like sales seminars was that there's a need behind the need, so the resistance points
yep.
are oftentimes not
exactly.
What?
That what you're talking about, and again, we're going to talk about it next week, is the notion that there is a difference between a position that a party takes and the interests that that party has. And by attempting to ascertain the underlying interests of a party, you can often uncover the fact that there are alternative ways of addressing that interest that don't necessarily consist of the things that are embodied in the position that's being articulated. And that'll become clearer next week when we talk about integrative bargaining. Other comments or questions about anything we've talked about today or about even the general structure of the course? No? That's good. Well, yes, Brittany.
The midterm, is it more
of
like a kind of a, I don't know, paper style, or like what?
Yeah,
I don't even know like what we've
it said. Usually is a two-part question for an essay response.
Okay.
And again, it's completely open book, and you know, it's not a matter of, you know, did I memorize X?
Right.
It is nonetheless very important that all of the topics that we cover in class up to that point be things for which you have done the readings, as well as you know, engaged in what we're talking about in class discussion, because inevitably the issues that are going to be raised in those questions are those very topics. If you see what I mean, okay. But we'll as we get closer to that, you know, we can certainly talk more about that. But I think if you really don't have any more questions, I can let you go for today. And let's make sure that all the people who are not currently registered are actually registered by next week. And let's also make sure that everybody has all the reading materials. And please, this is important, do the reading assignments when you're supposed to do them. We can't. I am hopeful that I will not be doing as much pure lecturing going forward as I did today. But in order for that to be the case, you've got to do the readings so we can have more of an interchange and dialogue. Okay, so that's important. And it